Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. September is peak month for songbird migration in the Buckeye State. If you can't spot them in the skies, you might be able to hear them. You can listen for the call of the rose-breasted grosbeak, for example. I don't know if I could pick that out of a crowd, but joining us for more on that and other migrating birds and the American Birding Expo this weekend in Columbus is author, publisher, and editor of Birdwatcher's Digest and founder of the American Birding Expo, Bill Thompson III. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann.
Let's talk about the migration first.
Yes.
How do you measure the breadth and depth of the fall migration? How do you describe it?
Well, you know, in spring, we kind of have these waves that come with the warm weather fronts that hit, and it's more in waves. Whereas I would say in fall, it's more like a flowing river because the birds just kind of move south. The weather's okay, and large, you know, later in the fall, we'll get a cold front and a bunch of stuff will move through or move out. But it's a slower progression. It's actually more enjoyable for a bird watcher in some ways because you never know what you're going to see day to day. Whereas in the spring, it's sort of like, okay, the hummingbirds show up about this time, and the warblers about this time, and the orioles about this time. So it's more protracted and actually more varied and interesting in the fall, I think.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Bill Thompson III. He's the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatcher's Digest, and he's here this week for the American Birding Expo. It's a showcase of products for birders and nature enthusiasts. It's at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus this weekend. Admission is free. Donation is requested, and we're going to talk about where that donation will go to coming up later, and it's open to the public. I went to it last year, and it was amazing how many people from around the world were there to pitch themselves as destinations for birdwatching.
Yeah, it's largely a travel show. We also have a lot of other stuff there, though. Several backyard companies,
yeah.
Some decorative stuff, a lot of artists this year, and optics, of course. But yeah, I would say a good 65% of our exhibitors, we have 107 exhibitors this year, are travel oriented, either tour companies or tour operators or destinations, lodges. And some countries have come, their country tourism representatives are here, like from Guyana and Trinidad and Tobago and so forth.
You showed me that you have, there's a networking event tonight and, everyone gets a flyer with where they can chuck off everybody they meet from different countries.
Right. This is for our exhibitors, right?
Right.
To get to know each other. And you know, often when you go to a show like this, there's a lot of contacts you could make with the other exhibitors, but you don't have a chance because you're so busy during the show talking to consumers. So we wanted our exhibitors to have a chance to get to know each other. In many cases, they're Facebook friends or they do business, but they've never met in person. So tonight, the person who sees meets the most people and checks off the most wins a secret prize.
Okay. As far as artists go, one of them, of course, is the incomparable Julie Zicafus,
right.
Your spouse, who's a wonderful artist, also prolific author. She'll be there. She wasn't there last year, but she'll be there this year.
She was in South Africa last year, so I didn't feel sorry for her. But a lot of people said, you know, hi, Bill, where's Julie? You know, that's the standard. Sometimes I think that's my last name, Mr. Zicafus. But yeah, Julie's going to be there setting up today, and she'll be there all the whole weekend for the expo. She's giving a talk on Sunday afternoon at, I think, 1 o'clock, that's open to the public and free, and it's on her baby birds book. So it'll be Sunday's
her newest book, yeah.
Yeah, Sunday's family day at the expo, so we expect there'll be a lot of families there learning about baby birds, which are uglier than you might think, but
no, I
fascinating.
Think they're adorable. She's made me really appreciate how cute they are. As far as you compare it and contrast the spring migration and the fall migration, it's more protracted in the fall. Are there different places to see it in Ohio than there are in the spring?
Okay. Well, I mean, a good birding spot is really a good birding spot.
All the time.
Especially for songbirds.
Okay.
But there are some, you know, things that you can do to catch more of the migration depending on what time it is. Like right now, going to any one of the metro parks that the golden jewel necklace around Columbus, any of those is going there in the morning, we'll have birds coming through, thrushes and warblers and vireos. And, you know, we're there at Scioto Audubon Metro Park right along the river. And just this morning, I mean, it was not as loud as spring migration in terms of song, but a lot of little chip notes and buzz notes and call notes of the birds coming right along the river, just moving slowly down. And so, you know, really any place that's an edge habitat right now would be great. So a field up against woods or along a river where the riparian woods follow along the river, anything like that. Even like along the jogging paths, the bike trails, it's going to be fantastic because the birds will congregate there first. And if you get a place where the sun's hitting the trees first thing in the morning, that can be really great. There's usually another little peak around 9 o'clock too, if you just FYI. There's like the dawn peak of birds.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of settle in. And there seems to be, in my very – you know, sort of unscientific but experienced way, there's another little peak around between 9 and 10 of bird activity. And then it kind of calms down in the middle of the day. The birds are resting because, after all, most of them have been flying all night, right? So they land and eat and then rest during the day and then fly at night to conserve energy and avoid predators.
We opened with the call of the rose-breasted grosbeak. Let's hear it again to refresh our memory. Now it's that chip.
It's that squeak. And, you know, it sounds like an old tennis shoe on a gym floor.
Oh, that's right. It does.
Right?
Okay, yeah,
it's like
yeah.
Somebody turning to catch the basketball and there's a little squeak. That's a sound that you, if you tune into it, you'll hear it this time of year here in Ohio a lot. You hear it in the spring too, but of course the males are also singing in the spring. But the males and the females and the young birds that are just hatched this summer, they're making that call as they head south. And you can sometimes even hear it at night when they're flying over.
Now, you say they're making that call.
Yeah.
There's a purpose.
Yeah. You know, sort of like when you're traveling, you like to know there are other people that are kind of traveling. You know, traveling, birds are kind of have a slightly
Is anybody
pack
else
mentality.
Out there?
Yeah. I mean, birds are social creatures. And, you know, they often will land and make some call notes like that to see if there's anybody else around. And you can, if you squeak back at them, you know, sometimes they'll come out to see, oh, that's my friend maybe, or that's somebody like me. They use it to keep in touch. And especially at night when they can't really see, you know, if you go out on a calm, still night, no wind, and you're somewhere fairly quiet without a lot of traffic noise, you can hear birds going over this time of year, just little tss, tss, tss. Sometimes there's a chip note or an eek like the uh-huh. rosebreast does. And that's the birds, the contact calls. They're keeping in touch with their other flockmates that are kind of generally moving south together, not in a cluster like you see the blackbirds during the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're all headed the same direction. They're keeping in touch.
You know, I would say that's probably the biggest drag about doing a lot of watching and listening around the bike path mm-hmm. along the, you know, the Olentangy River is that the highway's on the other side of
sure.
it. And it really drowns out a lot sure. of sound.
But like if you get up to High Banks,
yeah.
north of town,
yeah.
or you go down to Darby Creek
yep.
or down to like Clear Creek.
Yeah.
It's nice and quiet. And, you know, you get out there on a peaceful morning. I mean, there's something about the cool fall mornings and that golden light, you know, and then all of a sudden you'll see the tree wiggling a little bit because there's a bird
yeah.
that's just, you know, moving through. That's I love that so much. And fall for a bird watcher has some little mysteries to unravel that are, you know, the birds, a lot of them look different. They don't have their adult breeding plumage in many cases. And it's fun to kind of, I know what that is now. Oh, yeah, that's a chestnut-sided warbler or whatever.
Mm-hmm. But it's a baby or a teenager.
You know, or the, in some cases, like with the chestnut-sided warbler, the males lose all their color and they look
oh.
just like the females in
okay.
the fall. So you know, not all birds do that, and people get freaked out by confusing fall warblers, but it's really neat once you kind of tune into it.
Is the call of the rose-breasted grosbeak the same for male and female?
Yeah.
Okay.
And juveniles, too.
Okay.
That's their call note, and that little eek, no other bird really makes that call. And it's, if you think of that tennis shoe squeaking on a wooden gym floor,
yeah,
I know what that
I'm
is.
I'm gonna remember that.
Yeah.
That's a great description. Does the grosbeak make other sounds?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a rose-breasted grosbeak male has and sometimes you'll hear females singing too, but the males sing this incredible throaty warble. It sounds like a more musical robin or a more musical house finch,
okay,
real warbly and rich, and it's a beautiful song. And, you know, they nest in northern Ohio and kind of down a little bit into, like, the Hocking Hills. But it's not a bird, like, we're right in Marietta where we live, Whipple. We're right on the southern edge of their nesting range. So we don't get to hear them all summer.
Yeah.
We hear them in the spring when they come through. And often, you know, that's a bird that will show up at your bird feeder because they've got big seed-eating bills.
Oh, okay.
And they come back, they eat tree buds most of the year and insects. But they'll come back and they'll hit the sunflower seed at your feeder on their way north because the buds aren't out yet.
Right.
So it's oftentimes you'll look out at your feeder in the spring and you'll see a male rosebreasted grosbeak. You're like, what is that?
This obviously you said you're right there at the Scioto Audubon park, and how many is there every morning? There is a bird watching trip scheduled, right?
We have. I mean, they're very informal.
Okay,
we've got a lot of our
people go there anyways for their own. Yeah.
I mean, it's great birding there because there's it's the people don't realize this, but it's on top of the old landfill for Columbus and the old impound lot.
I remember.
So now it's this beautiful green space. It's got a wetland down at the bottom and, of course, the climbing wall and the big, huge rugby, football, soccer field. But then all along the river are these trees that are pretty big for a city. And that's the birds flying over. That's like concrete, concrete, concrete. Oh, there's some woods. I'm going in there. So they kind of self-select into this little strip of habitat. So it can be super birdy. Yesterday, I mean, I didn't have my binocs because I'm setting up the show. I mean, I would say easily 40 species were right around there. And, of course, because the river's there, you get osprey and bald eagle and all the gulls and egrets and herons and ducks and, of course, our friend the Canada goose.
I go and talk to him every day outside. All right. So let's talk about another one, the Swainson's thrush.
Yes.
Let's hear this.
That's neat because you can hear them singing in the background.
Yeah, that's something. Someone's like, someone's whistling. Come on over here.
Exactly. But from a distance, they also make that sound. It sounds like a spring peeper.
Okay.
Again, this is one of these calls that if you tune into it, you're like, oh, yeah, that little note. I know what that is. What is that? And Swainson's thrushes have the typical spiraling up beautiful thrush song that they sing all spring and summer. And sometimes you get to hear them if they're really fired up on a fall morning. But because they don't nest right here in Ohio, they're coming down from the boreal woods up north. We don't see them during the breeding season, so we don't get to hear them. We have wood thrushes and, we have some hermit thrushes in some parts of the state. Swainson's comes back through this time of year and all through into October. And if you're out early, you'll hear them. And they migrate in waves of thrushes. So on a good thrush morning, you'll hear that call a lot. And they like to keep in touch with each other. So it's not spring peeper because it's fall.
Do they travel with each other?
They do in kind of loosely affiliated flocks. Now, some of the larger birds like cranes and waterfowl, geese, they'll be in family groups and sometimes multi-year family groups.
Okay.
But the songbirds typically don't. A typical songbird migration is the males will leave first or the adults leave first. The young are around a little bit longer and then they go after. That's an oversimplification. But so, for example, our hummingbirds, ruby-throated hummingbirds, the males come in first and they leave first. And what's left is females and young that are still, fueling up for migration. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the ruby-throated hummingbird males are already gone from Ohio.
Yeah. My guest, we're talking about obviously birds. My guest is, can't really chat with anyone better than Bill Thompson, the 30s editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. He's in town today because he is your founder.
Well,
co-founder.
Yeah, the big cheese.
You're the big cheese, boss of the American Birding Expo. It's the second year now. It's a showcase of products for birders and nature enthusiasts. It's at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus this weekend. Admission's free. They're asking for donations at the door. We're going to talk about what those donations go to coming up. There's a local, a state, and a national, or a local, national, and international beneficiary of the funds this year. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment about fall birding with Bill Thompson. You can also check out our Facebook page and put a question or a comment there if you have one. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's peak songbird migration season in Ohio. We're talking about what you can see and hear as the birds head south. Still with us is author, publisher, and editor of Birdwatchers Digest, Bill Thompson III. He's in town for the American Birding Expo at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Granger Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus. For more information, visit the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. You'll be able to learn all about it. You have been traveling a bit, Israel, Portugal, England, and Germany since last year. What'd you see in Israel?
Well, I was over there for this thing called Champions of the Flyway, and it's some friends of mine who are Israeli birders in the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel started a bird race to raise money for conservation.
A bird race.
Right. So teams from all over the world, I think they had 22 teams from 12 countries last year. And then there are a bunch of Israeli teams too, and Israeli-Palestinian teams and so forth. And they race in the southern third of Israel from like south of Tel Aviv down to Eilat. And you can bird anywhere in that triangle of southern Israel for 24 hours. And all the teams are generating money for this one cause. And they pick a different bird life country every year along the Mediterranean flyway, where most of the birds from Asia and Europe go right through a couple of flyways right down and then into Africa. And all along the way, there's a culture of catching the birds and killing them to eat, of shooting them for sport, of trapping them just really for fun. So BirdLife International, which is one of our international partner for the expo, is involved in this Champions of the Flyway bird race. And last year, my friend Jonathan, who started the Champions of the Flyway, asked me to write a song for the event to help raise money. And so I wrote this song.
Bill's also a musician and songwriter. Go ahead.
Yeah. The Rain Crows, we performed it. And the song went kind of viral in the bird room and kind of a little bit beyond. And it was called River of Birds in the Sky. And so we did a video with it, and we raised a lot of money. I think we raised $70,000 for this. And it all went to Greece last year, to the Greek BirdLife partner. And that's to educate kids to not kill birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's okay. And a bird race, though, is that a thing?
Yeah, it is. It is. There are lots of them. There's the World Series of Birding here in the U.S. and the Texas Birding Classic. And there are these, you know, every year, typically in spring, there are these birding competitions. And almost all of them have at their root a conservation cause. So you're raising money for something. Sometimes it's individual teams raising for whatever they want to. In this case, all the money raised goes to one cause. It's all pooled up and it's dumped into one country, one bird life partner, and they use the money to educate people and to fight the illegal killing of birds.
So a bird race, I know it probably is obvious. It starts at one point and they race to another point, but how does it work?
Well, it's usually not from one point to another. Okay. It's usually within 24 hours, what team can see the most birds?
Oh.
So
I thought it was a race. Okay.
So you got to catch the birds along the way. It's like Pokemon Go, right? No.
Okay.
No. No, it's a competition to see the most birds. And so in some of the cases, you know, it's like you get $1 per bird, you know, from your sponsors. In our case, we just raised money flat out. Our team raised almost $13,000. So we won the prize for raising the most money, and we won the prize for doing the most to promote the cause because of the song and everything. And we were really proud of it. It was super fun. And our team was Birdwatchers Digest and Zeiss, and we were called the Way Off Coursers because we stayed in one place too. We sat in one park for the whole 24 hours, and all the other teams were racing around. And we came in seventh of all the teams that raced.
The birds came to you.
Yeah, they did. I mean, we just thought that was more in keeping with conservation, you know, being in one place, not waste the gas. So that's what we did.
Germany and England. You were there. Israel, Portugal, England, Germany. Mm-hmm. You're going to be headed to,
going to India and Honduras before the end of the year.
And I know Honduras. I mean, I've heard you've been there before.
Doing another bird race there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is called the Honduras Birding for Conservation Tour, and people sign up to be on a team of me and four other guides.
Okay.
And then we're
you're like a celebrity, right?
Well,
no, you are.
But we're with a local Honduran guide, and then our group, we rotate around to various places in Honduras, again, raising money to promote conservation in Honduras. So it's a worthy cause, and it's fun to be able to go and do these things.
Is birding as big around the world as it is here?
It's bigger in some places.
Where?
I mean, England, the Netherlands. I mean, in England, the per capita number of birders is probably maybe almost twice what it is here. I mean, when I was a student over there in the early 80s, the birding was like, everybody's like, oh, yeah, you're a birder. That's a bird watcher. That's great. You know, it was not didn't have the social stigma that it did here growing up, you know, in the United States. Miss Jane Hathaway, you know, from Beverly Hillbillies, which is gone now, thank God. But, you know, no, there are parts of the world where birding is huge. And then there are other parts where it's just emerging, like India. I mean, there's been a small bit of birding there, but now it's starting to spread out into the general populace. And a lot of places in Central and South America, birding is becoming a thing.
If you can make it in India, you can make it anywhere.
That's what they say.
I mean, it's the most populous country in the world, right?
That's right. That's right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about birding. It's the fall migration season now. My guest is Bill Thompson III. He's the editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest. He's also the author of many, many birding books. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm lucky enough to have him here in the studio today because he is running the American Birding Expo. It's a showcase of products for birders and nature enthusiasts, and there are different events associated with it held at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus this weekend. It's down there on the peninsula downtown. If admission's free, there is a request for a donation, though. And once again, we're going to talk a little bit more about what that donation goes to and a few minutes. In the meantime, 614-292-8513. Alice in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I have a question. I wondered why you didn't put all of the optics companies together in the main building instead of putting in some of the bookstores and touring companies and stuff. I would like them all to be together so that it's easier for me to compare optics.
I understand. Yeah. We had requested our two big optics retailers wanted to be separate.
Okay.
They want one wanted
That's
to be outside,
want,
one
would
be inside. Yeah. And a couple of the retailers wanted to be right there. It's about, I would say it's about 75 yards between the two.
Uh-huh.
It's not that far. But yeah, there's the company that's inside is Eagle Optics, and they're a big sponsor, and they're the preferred retailer because they're a sponsor. So we put them inside, and also have Timon Optics, Robert Hirschberger and his staff. They're going to be outside. They've got a huge booth outside and a whole lot of stuff to sell out there. And Opticron is out there with them, as is, I think, Vanguard. So it's a nice – and there's lots of stuff to see in between those
two
places.
That's for sure. Alice, thanks for the call. You know, the optics issue, I remember when I was walking with you and Julie Zikafoos a couple – 3 or 4 years ago out at the Audubon Park. Mm-hmm. She was letting me look through her camera.
Mm-hmm.
She was using her camera. She said she just kind of – fell in love with that approach because she could take a picture if she wants to as well. And it was a really nice way to look.
That's a huge trend right now with a lot of younger birders, especially because the cameras have gotten so much lighter and better.
Yeah.
And you can get more magnification without having a huge, long, heavy lens.
Yeah.
It's expensive. And you can look at the picture after and figure out what it is. There's a wave of kids, and not just kids, but, you know, people of all ages, really. But it seems to be folks who grew up with technology in their hands as opposed to binoculars, which is technology. It's just not digital. Like you can. So the cool thing is you could take a picture with one of these new point and shoot cameras. And if it's got Wi-Fi enabled, which a lot of them do, you can, if you don't know what it is, you can post it online and people can tell you, help you identify it, or you can send it to your friends. Or if it's a rare bird and you know what it is, you can get the word out right away. So it's a cool way to do it. And a lot of people like that because they love capturing the image of the bird.
Morgan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I would really like to teach them more about birds, but as you can imagine, they do not sit still and be quiet very well. And I was going to ask if you guys had any tips for introducing birding to them.
Now, Bill, you have a book out for children in birding.
Yeah, I wrote the Young Birder's Guide a few years ago, working with my daughter when she was in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. And the book's kind of aimed at 8 to 12 year olds. But, you know, the main suggestion for me is go somewhere like the Scioto Audubon Metro Park or one of the other metro parks around Hoover Reservoir where you can see big birds. And you don't even need to use optics. You can look at eagles and egrets and herons and things like that, naked eye. Even better, if you want to come down to the expo this weekend, we've got a bunch of spotting scopes out and they'll be trained on the birds down in the wetland. And that's a great way for a kid to look at birds with a spotting scope because it's steady. They don't have to hold the binoculars up to their eyes. And there's a little bit of a learning curve with getting to use binoculars. So start out with the big, impressive, easy-to-see birds. And then if the kids are interested and they seem to be taken by that, then turn them loose with a simple little field guide and their own pair of binoculars. You can get a starter pair of binoculars for $60 now. It's not much. And they'll be durable and last.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Morgan. You know, they talk about golf as a good walk spoiled. Mm-hmm. But another thing, you know, particularly at the Metro Park, the Audubon Metro Park, it's a good walk enhanced when you're they have hiking trails, places you can walk around, and it's quite beautiful.
Yeah. And
you can see beautiful birds.
And you can see and it's, you know, you can get a little vacation from the city. I mean, there, you can still hear the city and see it all around you, but you're kind of out in nature, and that's a real treat.
I wanted to do another bird call. There is the bright yellow American goldfinch. It breeds later than most North American
right.
birds, I guess. They're still nesting in late summer. Here's a bit of the goldfinch.
That's
so
kind
it's
of
got that high pitch thing, and then it.
That's kind of a call. It's not really the song that they do, which they're still doing a bit of, but. The reason I suggested that one is the first batch of baby goldfinches is out of the nest now. So the goldfinch waits until later in the summer because they line their nests with thistle down.
Okay.
So they eat the seeds and they line their nest with the white thistle down, and it's a beautiful soft nest. It's the only North American songbird that feeds its young a diet that's entirely seeds. So when cowbirds lay their eggs in goldfinch nests, the cowbird chick never survives because they can't survive on all seeds like a baby goldfinch can.
They need the worms and the
yeah, the insects
thing.
And yeah. other kinds of protein. So anyway, right now, if you feed birds and you've got goldfinches in your backyard, you'll hear the babies cheep, 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 begging from their parents. And they follow their parents around. And if you're really tuned into it, it can drive you kind of nuts because these are insistent little birds and they never shut up. Even when they're being fed, they're still going chideep, chideep, chideep. So that's a call that's kind of filling the air right now because the first ones have just come out of the nest and there'll be later broods, you know, over the next couple of weeks. But that late nesting gives you a lot of bird noise in your backyard.
How does it affect their migration?
Well, see, goldfinches are kind of facultative migrants. They move around. Like a lot of our goldfinches here in Ohio are resident. Some of them may, from farther north, may move a little bit south, but they only go far enough south until there's food. And
just to survive.
Yeah. So when we have one of those finch invasion years like we had a couple years ago, that's usually because the northern seed crop, you know, pine seeds and the weed seeds and birch seeds and things like the alder seeds has failed because of either drought or too much rain or insects or just a cyclical problem. Those birds all come south looking for food, and that's called an eruption when they come south like that. Goldfinches are much more normal about that. They just kind of roam around looking for food wherever, and they don't really migrate. They'll move farther south or one direction or another if there's a shortage of food.
They change colors, though, don't they,
in the
seasons?
They do, and they're starting to lose that bright yellow color right now that they picked up in March and April. And the males hold that all through the summer. Even the females are brighter.
Right.
But they're still duller than the males. And then the males will gradually become, to the point where they look just like the females. They're kind of olivey yellow. Drab.
Why do they do that? Do we know?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of theories about it. One is that the males want to be brightly colored and beautiful so that the females notice them.
Okay, they're attracting females.
And there's also this, I'm a male goldfinch, I'm defending this territory, you know. There's, they're
kind of like
regal
the cardinal.
Finery.
Yeah.
But then why doesn't a cardinal change completely? Why doesn't it go dull? Male cardinals stay the same all year long. So we don't really know why one bird, you know, two seed-eating birds, both resident in our backyards, why does one change and the other one doesn't? We don't really know. All we can do is sort of admire it and go, wow. So I will get the call this winter, as I do every winter. Somebody says, where are my goldfinches? I've got these little olivey birds at my feeder, but my bright yellow goldfinches, where are they?
Okay. It's like they change their outfit.
They just change colors.
Lynn in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lynn.
I had been hearing the call around north central Ohio of a bird, and it seems to say theater, theater, tweet, 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 tweet. And I've been looking online and trying to do some research, but I couldn't find out what it was.
Well,
ring a bell?
It could be one of a couple of different birds. I mean, Carolina wrens go tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle, which is sort of like theater, theater, theater. A goldfinch can kind of sound twittery like that. Tufted titmouse can sound like that. And so, I mean, it's probably one of those birds, but, you know, if you can get a recording of it and send it in, we can try to try to tell you what it is. It's there's so many birds that have a triple note, like a da 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 da. It's a pretty typical.
Yeah.
It's like all blues sounds the same.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a lot of birds have a triple note like that, and Carolina wren could be a good one. That's a pretty good. They're singing a lot right now. They sing all year long.
Okay, Lynn, thanks for that call. Francine and Waldo, you're on the air. Hi, Francine.
Hi. I have a question about the wood thrushes. I've heard them all summer back in the woods, and now I don't hear them anymore. And I just wonder, when do they leave and head south?
That's a great question. Wood thrushes are leaving right now. They're not singing so much now because, you know, what makes the males sing is the testosterone levels in, that rise up in the spring and get them ready for the breeding season. And one thing you can listen for right now is early in the morning and later, like at the end of the day at dusk, listen for a pit, 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 kind of like that. That's sometimes the wood thrushes, if they're still around, will be making that call. And it's, again, it's just a contact call, basically saying, I'm here. Are there any other wood thrushes? It's like calling on the CB radio, you know, anybody out there got their ears on. So that's that pit, pit, pit. You can often hear that if you go online and Google wood thrush pit, pit, pit call, you'll be able to hear it.
All right, Francine, thanks a lot for that call. If anyone else has a question or comment for my guest, Bill Thompson, the third editor and co-publisher of Birdwatchers Digest, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bill is in town to run the American Birding Expo. It's the second year in a row. It's a showcase for birders and products for birders and nature enthusiasts. It's at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking birds and bird watching this hour. Still with us is publisher and editor of Birdwatchers Digest. He's also the author of numerous books, Bill Thompson III. He's here for the American Birding Expo at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus this weekend. For more information, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. What's new this year at the Expo?
Well,
or just more of everything?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a couple more companies there selling backyard products. Droll Yankees, the famous feeder manufacturer, is there.
Okay.
Wild Birds Unlimited is there. Tom Sheely's got his part of his store there from, you know, the famous Wild Birds Unlimited here in Columbus, Ohio. And we've got some other new things there. There are a couple of people there selling sculpture, like little, you know, metal sculptures, and a couple more artists.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're trying a little bit to do a better job of the talks. A lot of our exhibitors want to give a presentation while they're here. So we've really organized that well. And if people are interested in hearing a talk on any one of the countries represented by our exhibitors, there's a good chance they can do it. And all the talks are free, and there's a schedule up on our website, and we'll have it posted on the grounds as well.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to walk from booth to booth and
have quality
strike
time.
Up a conversation with every single person, and lots of people like to just sit back and listen maybe.
Well, yeah, they do. And then we're also doing at the end of – we've kind of grouped the talks, so all the South American ones will go and all the European ones. And then at the end of those – there's a panel discussion from that region that our friends from the American Birding Association are going to be sort of coordinating. And so we'll be able – people who are interested in going to Asia for birding can come in and talk to all the Asian operators that are giving presentations and ask questions about the area in general.
Or I would think if you're traveling to any of these places for any reason, you could also learn more about them by going to the Birding Expo and just – it's another thing to pay attention to. Let's see. Murray in Mauro County, you're on the air. Hi, Murray.
Good morning. I'm calling about cats, both owned and feral.
Mm-hmm.
I am a former cat owner. I like cats, but they are devastating as far as the bird population goes. Does the guest have any thoughts on either philosophical or actual approaches to managing the cat situation?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one of those dilemmas because you have people who understand the biological impact of cats and feral cats especially, and how many birds they kill, and not just birds, other creatures as well, and the health hazards they present to other wildlife and to inside cats. And then, of course, you have people who just love cats and are just can't stand to think that there's a cat out there that's not being fed and so forth. It's interesting. There's a new book out called Cat Wars that's about this very issue, and it's published by Princeton University Press. I think one of the first places it'll be on sale is at the expo, and one of the authors may even be there to sign the books. But it's they examine it from a historical perspective, biological and epidemiological. It's a huge controversy, and the folks that are in favor of trapping the cats, neutering them, and putting them back out in nature and keeping them fed, they have a hard time understanding from a biological standpoint that that's basically a magnet. Any bird coming in there is probably doomed. Once – many people don't know this. Cat catches a bird and it bites it. Once a cat's saliva enters a bird's system, it's very, very toxic for the bird. We get tons and tons of rehab birds here in places like the Ohio Wildlife Center, get tons of cat-caught birds. If a cat breaks the skin and that saliva gets into the bird system, it's pretty much lights out for the birds. So it's – cats aren't a natural predator in the North American system.
Mm-hmm.
And feral cats are a huge problem. They kill billions of birds a year. It's a huge problem. That we have lots of other problems that kill birds,
mm-hmm.
windows,
people.
Agricultural chemicals and things. But this is one we can control. And so I am not a cat person, but I understand people that do love cats, and I don't wish any ill on cats that are inside and well-behaved. But the healthiest place for a cat is inside, being cared for, being protected from cars and disease. And, a lot of cats that roam free, they have to dodge coyotes and foxes and raccoons and, traffic. And, so it's a big controversial thing. I think it's a pretty clear answer on how we can manage it fairly and equitably and in a way that's good for nature.
Murray, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Evan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hey, I have a question about – first of all, I know it's kind of trendy to despise grackles because they're so abundant, they're very intelligent.
They're aggressive, and they take over my bird feeder.
they do that, and they're also very noisy. But mm-hmm. one of the most beautiful and complex bird songs I've ever heard in North America is that of the boat-tail grackle,
right.
Which is common to the American Southwest and Southeast. And I know that they are migratory. They move north and south between the southern tiers of the United States all the way down to southern Mexico seasonally. However, I think that I have seen them farther north than most of the maps and texts suggest their range extends. And I'm wondering if due to climate change and global warming, if they are, in fact, extending their range perhaps as far north as Ohio, because I think I've seen them in Kentucky and Tennessee.
Sure, yeah. Grackles are really, really resourceful birds, like starlings.
Resourceful is a nice word.
Well, they'll eat anything, right? they'll get under your bird feeder and pick through the duff and, eat the little bits of sunflower and stuff. They'll get into a cornfield. I've seen them converge on an old-fashioned corn crib and just cling to the sides of it and eat the corn. They are really resourceful birds. They are persecuted, and I think that's a subject for a book someday, is Why do we hate black birds? People hate crows. They hate grackles. They hate starlings. They're evil.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But that's another.
Yeah, another story for me.
I think grackles are amazing birds. They're savvy. They're smart. They can be aggressive. I've seen them nail a house sparrow right on the head and gobble them down. I mean, they are.
They'll eat anything.
They will. But I don't know that they're a good bellwether for global warming because they can survive harsh conditions. They do migrate south, but you always see these early. I think one bellwether might be when the flocks of red-winged blackbirds start arriving in the spring, and often there are grackles mixed in those flocks in the spring. But, you know, as a global warming bellwether, no, not so much, because they can be anywhere at any time and they can survive super harsh conditions as long as there's some French fries at a drive-thru to eat, or literally, I mean, they will eat anything. It's funny, out west, there's a bird called a Brewer's Blackbird that's completely become adapted to living on sidewalks. And a lot of people call them mall birds because they just walk along outside the restaurants, along the streets out in the west, and they look like a mini grackle. But it's a Brewer's Blackbird, and it's really a Great Plains nesting bird, but they've just kind of adapted to living off of French fries and bits of croissant and whatever. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. These birds are so resourceful. They'll fit into any niche and thrive. Not just survive, thrive.
Mm-hmm.
In that way, I admire the grackles a lot. And if you ever see a grackle in beautiful sunlight at the iridescence, I mean, it's cool.
They are pretty.
They are.
Evan, thanks for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, as I said, the American Birding Expo this weekend is free, but a donation is requested. And one of the causes, there's a local cause. It's the Young Urban Naturalist Program. What's that?
Well, actually, the name of that has just been changed to Conservation Classroom.
Okay.
And the Grange Insurance Audubon Center is just south of downtown, just west of German Village. It's in the heart of the Scioto Audubon Metro Park. It's this incredible LEED certified recycled building. It's beautiful.
Absolutely.
It's got classrooms in there, and tons and tons and tons of school kids from the Columbus area go there every year to get out and wade in the marsh and go along the river and appreciate nature. And for a lot of kids in cities, that's about the most nature they're going to get in the course of a school year. Because, you know, if your schools are like ours down in Southeast Ohio, there are no field trips anymore.
Right.
You're not going out to the farmers, you know, to learn about this or that in nature. It's just not happening. So GIAC offers that to a lot of kids. And their conservation classroom program is designed to bring kids there in groups and get out and look at birds and look at fish and look at butterflies and look at plants. And basically, you know, immerse themselves in nature for just a little bit. And you never know. Those could be the future environmental leaders of our country. It's, you know, the whole nature deficit disorder thing, which we've talked about here before, where kids are tuned into their phones and their iPads and their devices and their Game Boys, and they're just not outside. You know, Richard Louv, the famous author who coined the phrase nature deficit disorder, said he asked a kid, where's your favorite place to play? And the kid said, wherever there's a plug where I can plug in my device. So organizations like GIAC, Grange Insurance Audubon Center, and the folks at the Metro Parks are doing, you know, incredible work at attaching kids and connecting kids to nature. So the conservation classroom is our local cause. Our national cause is working with our friends at the American Birding Association to help preserve and study the red knot.
Never heard of it before. Not saying much when it comes to me, but you know,
it's a plump shorebird that back in the market gunning days in the late 1800s was shot because they would come and fatten up, and they were these plump, delicious, fatty birds that were, you know, the people ate in restaurants all up and down the East Coast.
Huh.
But now the problem with red knots is they're vanishing habitat. They feed on ephemeral hatches of things like mussels or like horseshoe crab eggs.
Okay.
And they can only feed on horseshoe crab eggs on the Delaware Bay shore where the horseshoe crabs are.
Right.
You know, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, right in there.
At
certain times when the horseshoe crabs come up and lay their eggs. And that's usually the first 2 weeks of May. Well, the horseshoe crabs are being harvested and ground up for fertilizer. Of course, the coastal areas are being gobbled up by development. And so they're being squeezed into this narrow, and the seas are rising.
Yeah.
So the red knot's getting hammered from every direction. This is a bird that nests in the Arctic and flies all the way to the southern tip of South America and winters down there. And all along the way, they're feeding on these ephemeral hatches or availability of this ephemeral food source, whether it's mussel.
Why do you call it ephemeral?
Ephemeral because it's here now for a little bit and it's gone.
Temporary. Yeah, yeah.
And they have to hit it at that time. And if because of temperature rise in the sea and if the horseshoe crabs are nesting earlier or later and the red knots aren't there to catch those a bounty of eggs and protein, they're not going to make it to the Arctic to nest.
Yeah.
So the populations have crashed over the years. We're 90% down in the RUFA race of the red knot since the 70s. Our international cause is BirdLife International. We're working with them to help save the critically endangered hooded grebe in Argentina. And we're a species champion for the hooded grebe, so we are devoting a third of the money we raise from the conservation fund to helping to save the hooded grebe in Patagonia in Argentina. So that's our international cause.
Mike in Lithopolis, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ann. So we have a pond on our property surrounded by cattails, and in the spring we get literally hundreds of red-winged blackbirds that come in and nest, and then around the middle of the summer they all seem to take off. I'm wondering what's the timing on when they leave, and do you know where they go?
Yeah, the red-winged blackbirds, they're back early. I would argue that we should have a national referendum on what's the best sign of spring, because I would say it's the first male red-winged blackbird that comes back and starts singing from a cattail. That's a sign of spring. Robins are around all year. I hate to tell you. Burst in your bubble there. Hello, I saw the first robin of spring.
No.
It's been there. Anyway, so they get busy and nest early in the season, and it's timing when the richness of the aquatic insects are hatching and cattails are, you know, growing and thick, and they can nest way down in there, and they weave this little nest and suspend it from the cattails.
Really?
It's super cool. And one male can have like several females in a cattail patch. And the red-winged blackbirds are fascinating birds. Once that's done, you know, they can only do so many broods. If they lose the first brood to bad weather or a predator, they might go a second time, but they're not going to just crank out broods all through the year. So later in the year, the males take off and they kind of grow, gang up in these bachelor groups, and they go hang out in another set of cattails. And the females are left doing the hard work, you know, like in many cases, raising the young. And then so the males leave first, and then the females and the young leave after. And you'll see these huge flocks. You know, the murmurations you often see?
Yeah.
Well, from now,
that's where they fly in sync. It looks like they're in sync with each. Yeah. Well, they are.
And I mean, oftentimes with blackbirds, like red-winged blackbirds and grackles and cowbirds, you'll see a long line just along. And you can see it's just this like little army ant line in the sky.
Right.
Right. And that's blackbirds. They're just migrating south. And what they'll do is they'll find a place like a cornfield or, in some cases, a cattail marsh, and they'll roost there at night, and they'll pick up the next day and move farther. But theirs isn't just a straight north-south migration. They'll kind of, you know, drift this way or that depending on where there's safe roosting places and safe and good places to forage. So when people are harvesting their corn in the fall, in the autumn, the field corn, they'll land in the field and eat all the spilled corn, and
right. That's
perfect. And then they'll move a little bit farther south if they can. So they leave this time of year and kind of batch up in pre-migratory flocks, and then they'll start moving south as the weather gets colder and there's less to eat in the marshes. They'll move to the fields.
Mike, thanks for that call. I can't believe it, but the hour is up, Bill Thompson. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Ann. Always a thrill.
Bill Thompson III, he's editor and co-publisher of Birdwatcher's Digest, author of many, many birding books. And he's also in charge of the American Birding Expo. It's a showcase of products for birders and nature enthusiasts this weekend at the Scioto Audubon Metro Park and Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus. Check it out. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Jess Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrola, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me as well on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.